Greetings, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland Head School. And this is your Head School Master, Tommy Graham, editor of History Ireland magazine. Quote, better a state without public records than public records without a state, unquote. So said Winston Churchill in reference to the Irish Free State on hearing news of the destruction of the Public Records Office in the Four Courts in June 1922. But in many respects, so too was Northern Ireland, whose Public Records Office, or PRONI, didn't open its doors until 1924. How did these two institutions overcome this initial setback, and what has been their significance in state formation, archives, and commemoration? And this Head School is part of a wider digital event on Thursday, 24th of September, hosted by the Public Records Office of Northern Ireland in conjunction with Beyond 2022. And joining us on the panel today, we have Marie Coleman of Queen's University Belfast, Katrina Crowe, formerly of the National Archives of Ireland, Ray Gillespie of Maynooth University, and Neil Johnston of UK National Archives. And he's also representing the Beyond 2022 project, and more of that, more on that project in the course of the discussion. Now, my original intention was to start this discussion with the development of, you know, English medieval archives, where Irish archives, I suppose, have their origin. But Katrina Crowe, you wrote a very interesting review in last week's Irish Times supplement on this whole question. And I think it's an interesting one because it knocks on the head straight away any notion of Irish exceptionalism, because it seems that destruction of archives has been going on for centuries, if not millennia. Tell us a bit more about that.
Well, Tommy, I suppose what's amazing is the eternal human appetite for destroying knowledge, whether due to conflict, stupidity, accident, all kinds of reasons, usually conflict, as in our own case. And it was interesting for me to read the book because I've been obsessed for a very long time.
What's the book, Katrina, first? I forgot to mention the name, the title of the book.
The book is called Burning the Books, and it's written by Richard Ovenden, who's the Bodleian librarian, one of the oldest and most distinguished libraries in the world, which is based in Oxford. Beautifully written. He picks examples from the 7th century BC right up to the forthcoming Holocaust of digital records, which we're facing into now. And he very presciently points out that humanity at the moment is handing over vast amounts of private information to private multinational corporations that have no mandate to preserve that information for the common good, and on the contrary, are monetizing it and using it in all kinds of potentially sinister ways. So in between, it covers everything and anything. He doesn't, alas, deal with the fire in the Four Courts in 1922, which I was slightly peeved by. But to your point about Irish exceptionalism, there's so much more that we do become a rather smaller event in the history of world knowledge destruction. What's interesting also, as a British librarian, he doesn't hesitate to deal with British barbarity in terms of the destruction of records, one of the major periods, of course, being the destruction of the monasteries and the destruction of their fantastic libraries at that time, which affected both Britain and Ireland at the time. The British also destroyed the Infant Library of Congress in 1814 outside Washington. And that, again, one of the great subjects he has is recuperation, how people actually replace what was lost. In that case, Thomas Jefferson's library, which he sold, did not donate to the state, replaced the destruction of the Library of Congress. So the book gives you horrifying details of destruction, but also very hopeful stories of recuperation, not least during World War II, when people lost their lives to preserve very important Jewish archives and books. Where today the broader picture that we're looking at involves Beyond 2022, which is our great recuperative project now. Not to say that after the fire in 1922, various very dedicated archivists and other staff did their best to try to replace what had been lost. But this goes a level much higher, where we're looking at creating what may be a really wonderful international archive of Irish materials, digital.
Just before I go on to Neil, Katrina, one of the points I took from your review, from the book, is in relation to the Library of Alexandria, you know, and you get references in history to the destruction, cataclysmic destruction. And it seems that from that book, or from your comment, Donald, that it was neglect rather than cataclysm that led to the destruction of that particular library, which is a message we might send out to various governments and funding bodies. But Neil, let's get on to you. We'll get on to the detail of the Beyond 2022 project later in the discussion. But I just want to look at the origin of state archives in this part of the world. And of course, you know, for 800 years, we were under the jurisdiction of the neighbouring island. So I'm presuming then that the origin of this story, the immediate origin then, is the evolution of medieval English records. So could you tell us a little bit about that? What was their purpose? How did they evolve over time?
That's right, Tommy. Records are created for legal and administrative reasons, and they're kept for the same reasons. And what we're talking about is documentation produced by institutions, usually the Crown, or individuals within the implementation of the common law. So at the time, if you think of the Norman kings, the monarch conducted the practical business of the state through a court or council known as the Curia Regis, the King's Court. And this is an itinerant court which followed the king in the course of his travels as he moved around his kingdom. The business of the court produced written records, which form part of the king's treasure, and they're kept in whichever royal palace the king happened to be residing in at the time. And the outcome was the king's records are kept in a number of locations. Now, throughout the medieval period, government too became gradually more complex. By the 13th century, a number of distinct government entities distilled out of the king's council, which fulfilled different functions. So you have the exchequer, you have chancery, you have the courts of common law, the court of common pleas, and the king's bench. These came to have permanent courts at Westminster and ceased to travel with the king. So as the departments of the state, say chancery, which is the writing office or the royal secretariat, ceased to travel with the king and developed settled bases, their records came to be stored at settled places and at different locations. And the repositories were scattered across both London and then England. And each department becomes responsible for the preservation of their records and how these records could be searched identified is part of the story of what we're doing with Beyond 2022 now, trying to reconstruct this. The Irish records in England are there for a specific reason, because from 1170 onward, the earliest Irish-related record in England dates from 1170, as far as we're aware, where Henry II is gathering forces for an invasion of Ireland, and he is writing out to the shires, to knights in the shires, saying either pay up in money or send men for the force. And this, so while it's not an Irish record in that it's not created in Ireland, it's Irish-related, and this appears within the wealth of records from that reign. And when you move into King John's reign, the successor, as royal administration expands both in England and Ireland, you get Irish records and Irish-related records mixed through the daily business of royal government in England and Ireland.
So there's Irish material then right from the get-go there.
Absolutely,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, Ray, can I bring you in here? Because meanwhile, on this island, right, the Gaelic system, Brehon law, etc. I mean, until the arrival of Christianity, nothing was written down. It was an entirely oral system. And you had the writing of annals, for example, right? Now, could they be described as archives in their own way?
Yeah, I think it's kind of difficult. We're using a term like archives to mean lots of different things here. So that, for example, we talk about archives as sources. But archives, you know, are essentially the records of an administration. They contain information rather than knowledge. And that's why particular government structures find these things very, very useful and preserve them. But the way Gaelic Ireland worked was very different. Gaelic Ireland, in a way, is an older system than the common law system, which begins to come into England, which is about lordship over land. And lordship over land generates lots of bits of paper. Or lots of bits of parchment, as the case may be, because you need to be able to prove, I own this land, I own that land. Gaelic Ireland, on the other hand, is a different sort of world. It's a world where, you know, land really doesn't matter, because you have the population so low that you can have any bit of land that you want. Your problem is to get people on it. So the real problem, you know, is to get people who will follow you. So therefore, the sort of records which are produced in Gaelic Ireland are really very different from the sort of records which are produced in, shall we say, a centralized system, with like the common law system in England at the time. So you're talking about two different systems, what I would describe as lordship over land and lordship over men. And Gaelic Ireland's about lordship over men. So the records which that produces, we think of them as, you know, having been rather like the English centralized chancery system. And, you know, someone came along in the 17th century and destroyed all this. In fact, that wasn't the case at all, because most of what existed or did not exist. So that what they did, what we have surviving from Gaelic Ireland, those survived because those were the records not of an administration, but of the learned classes. Because the learned classes essentially were the spin doctors. They were the people who convinced you to follow the Lord. So you had to tell stories about how your Lord was great. And that's the bardic poetry, that's the annals that tell the stories of warfare, for example. So it's a very different type of record-making system, which is a product of the sort of society which makes it. So there's an awful lot less of it. And also, it doesn't have a centralized archive. It doesn't have a system. It doesn't centralize documents in one place. They're highly dispersed. So what these documents are, certainly in the Middle Ages, are very much part integrated into the social system. And when that social system changes in the 17th century from lordship over men to lordship over land, suddenly these documents become irrelevant. You know, there's no point in having bardic poetry anymore because it's no longer about persuading people to follow you. So these things, which were part of an organic social world, suddenly are cast out, and they become a rather different sort of thing in the 17th century. They become the resources for antiquarians. They become commercial, buying and selling these manuscripts among people like James Usher, James Ware, and these people collect these things. So these people, in fact, don't create an archive of Gaelic Ireland. The records of Gaelic Ireland are much more like what we would describe as private papers,
Ray, what about the work of the four masters in the 17th century? I mean, could that be described as the Beyond 2022 project of its day?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the four masters come with a particular mindset, and that mindset is to create a story of the Kingdom of Ireland. And, you know, Micheál O'Clery actually talks about this, that the Annals of the Four Masters were known in the 17th century. Four Masters is it's an invention by Colgan in the late 17th century, but they were called the Annals of the Kingdom of Ireland in the early part of the 17th century. And indeed, it's part of a much bigger project to deal with the genealogies of saints, and when they collect the lives of saints. And when they do this, Ward, who's behind all this, says, what more is there to do except write a context for all these other things? Write a history of Ireland. And that's what becomes the Annals. And the Annals, in many ways, are very difficult to deal with because they are, in one sense, very traditional. I mean, the form is very, very traditional. But in other ways, they are remarkably modern. And they bring the ideas of O'Clery and the continental ideas into Ireland.
Neil, can I just come to you there? Does any Irish language stuff crop up in the English archives?
It does, actually. They're land records, but we have found material last year or 2 years ago now. We discovered some in the Renzi records. He was a landowner in the Midlands, and he is corresponding with his tenants effectively, but in Irish. They're absolutely beautiful. We brought them to the attention of Brendan Kane over in Pennsylvania and other scholars, and they got really, really excited about them. And they're lovely, lovely documents. So there's a small few, and they emerge usually from legal cases.
And Katrina, just coming to you on this in terms of the Irish archives, I mean, would am I right in saying that Irish language stuff didn't really feature until independence, or am I wrong on that?
In terms of what was in the public record office, yes, but let's not be too reductive about what archives are. They also include not just the records of administrations, but also the records of counter-administrations like Gaelic Ireland, which had its own structures, as Ray has so eloquently told us. But they also include literary records, sometimes visual records like photographs. There are a whole range of other things that are not just to do with the administration of the country that are also considered to be archives. The vast manuscript collections that you have, for example, in the Public Record Office of Northern Ireland, which are private landed estate records, many of them relating to Southern Ireland, are absolutely archives, as are church records, as are all kinds of other things. In terms of the Irish language material, there's very little that I have seen that was in the National Archives post-independence, post the fire, or that turns up in Wood's Guide, which is our wonderful guide to what was there before 1922, written and published in 1919 by Herbert Wood, who was the keeper of records at that time. We get a lot of Irish language stuff after 1922, when the failed project to make us all learn Irish compulsorily takes off in a big way. And you've got material from places like the Department of Justice, where civil servants are writing to each other in Irish. All of that is going on. And one has to have a fairly good grasp of the language to be able to interpret that material, but not much before that. And Ray, of course, would be the expert on where these things are, but I know that there are a lot of our very great Irish language early manuscripts in the Royal Irish Academy, for example, and in other areas, but not, as far as I know, and that's the caveat, in the Public Record Office, either before or after the destruction.
Sorry, Ray, yeah, I want to come in on that.
Yeah, just to make the point, in some ways, you know, we wouldn't expect Irish language material to turn up in the old Public Record Office. There's some material. I mean, there was material that was destroyed. There are some pleadings in Irish from the Court of Chancery, for example. But the point about the Public Record Office is it's the archives of the Irish state in the 18th, 19th, and particularly the 20th century. And before the 20th century, Irish language was not something which figured within the Irish state as it was understood, meaning, if you like, the Kingdom of Ireland as defined by the 1541 Act. So if you're looking for Irish language material, there's no point in going to the National Archives and saying, please produce this. Where you need to go is to ask, you know, who collected this material, who preserved this material? And that's the private papers of Ware, Usher, and various others. That's why most of our Irish language material has ended up in England, for example, in the Bodleian, for example, where Ware's papers ended up. So you've always got to understand archives not as some desiccated pieces of paper, but as things which are embedded in a real social world. And they reflect the ideas of people who made them. People did not sit down and say, oh, Katrina Crowe is going to be on radio, I better generate some sources for her. What they did was they generated material which was useful for them every day, which people have then used subsequently in lots of different ways. So, I mean, I think archives, we can't really think about them in some sort of desiccated way. We have to think about them in a very particular social context as to why something is generated, why is it where it is, and how is it preserved, where it's preserved.
Now, in relation to state archives, right, I'm assuming that they developed in line with technology. I mentioned the invention of printing, for example, in the early modern period. But then, the massive expansion of the state coming into the 19th century. So, Neil, would it be true to describe, say, the 19th century as the sort of the archival moment?
Oh, of course it would, yeah. There's two things happening. The huge expansion of the state and the bureaucratic output, but also the idea of a researchable past emerges. Initially through fiction, the idea of a medievalism, so studying the medieval period, both in fiction and then by early historical scholars who actually called themselves archaeologists in that they were digging through records. And with that, then you get the emergence of the idea of a public record. It's usually based on the records that I deal with in my job in state records on legal records, as Ray said, to do with land, to do with disputation, and to do with proving ownership of something. But you get a movement across Europe and in England and then into Ireland about the need to create access to these public records. And that develops throughout the 19th century. It begins in the with a commission called the Record Commission in England, and then there's a sister version that's established in Ireland. And this is an effort to list and catalogue what survives. It functions in the first three decades. It ends up in a bit of disarray, political disarray, because it costs an awful lot of money, as archives tend to do. And the output wasn't felt sufficient, but it laid the groundwork for the establishment of the Public Record Office, well, first of all in England, and then later in the 1860s in Ireland.
I'll tell you what, I just want to go through the establishment dates for state archives, and thanks to Kieran Wallace for giving me this list. I'll just go through them. Austria, 1749, France, 1790s, Argentina, 1821, Britain, 1838, Turkey, 1840, Spain, 1866, Ireland, 1867, and we'll come back to that in a second, Egypt, 1870, Italy, 1875, Japan, 1880s, and surprisingly, USA, 1934, you know, surprisingly late. Marie, I want to go to you on this one, though, because this development of archives in the 19th century is very much associated with the historiographical approach of Leopold von Ranke, you know, the scientific approach to historiography. Now, you know, if it's said that the winners write the history, then surely the winners also compile the archives. Does this present challenges to historians in terms of, you know, real objectivity, if that's not a contradiction in terms?
No, I don't think it is, because I think any serious historian will recognise that from the outset. And the value of the state archive is that we do need to understand why the state did what it did. So we look at government documents, whether it's in the National Archives in London or in Bishop Street or up here in the Public Record Office of Northern Ireland, to understand why governments made policy decisions they did. So they are essential for that. But I think any serious historian will recognise that they are getting one perspective on that and will then go and seek the other perspectives. I'm just thinking, looking at the news over the last few days about the various back and forth over the Brexit negotiations and things like that, and I can see 20 years down the line, the historians will go and they'll go to the National Archives and look at the Irish government's version of it, and they'll go to Britain and look at the British government's version. So I think we all recognise that we're getting a particular view of it. Now, it's very important that we have that record, that those records are kept. And I think there's an obligation on government to leave behind evidence of how decisions of public policy were made. I think back to a controversy we had here in the north in the last few years over the renewable heat incentive, and the inquiry into that showed up a serious flaw in the failure to minute meetings between civil servants and politicians. Politicians, it appears, made it quite clear they didn't want these meetings minuted. So there's a problem there if you don't have the record in the first place. Mm-hmm. But comment really goes more to the use of the archive, and as I say, historians will recognise they're getting one perspective. But the state is not the only generator of those documents. I suppose to take another example that many of the listeners to this particular podcast will be familiar with is the Bureau of Military History, which again was a state-sponsored project in independent Ireland to record the records of the veterans of the revolutionary campaign, and one which is probably seen as having a bit more of a pro-treaty aura to it. But not necessarily the case that everybody who contributed to it were those on the treaty side, but there certainly was a bit more of a remove from the anti-treaty Republicans. And we look at those records, but most historians of this period will then balance what is contained in those statements, some of which seem to have been, the interviews were sent in a particular direction. So there may be a fear that they reflect a particular set of questions that those interviewers wanted asked. But you can compare them to something more free-flowing than like the interviews which Ernie O'Malley conducted with more predominantly Republicans. So what historians will do is recognise that potential bias, be aware of it themselves, but also go and look for other perspectives.
I just want to, and we're jumping ahead a little bit here, but you've raised the question of the military service pension files. Now, the thing is, when it comes to pensions, right, that's what the state is, you know, giving out money for something, right? So to get your pension, you have to say, you know, who shot who, on what bend of the road, exactly, you know, you had to have it verified by your commanding officer. Is there a danger there then that that telescopes all the focus on the military aspect of, say, the War of Independence, when I think the consensus seems to be amongst historians that this was a much broader political struggle? I mean, there's a danger there, surely.
Well, there is, and I suppose the assessment procedure that when the assessors of these pensions sat down, they had to come up with some sort of standard by which they would assess service. And for much of the period, there was this prerequisite that a successful applicant would have to show that they participated in what was known as a major engagement. But as anybody who has looked at those records will know, while that is there, there's a wide range of additional evidence which was gathered in the files. Either the applicants themselves would send it in, or people writing references would add in extraneous material. So often you don't know what you're going to find. So I think that is probably the most, if I can use the word, thrilling thing about archives, is just when you open up one of those files, or more increasingly now, click on one of them, you just don't know what you're going to find.
And there is a challenge as well to people, you know, the writing of women's history, right? Because, for example, in the military pensions, if you were female, you weren't regarded as a combatant, even if you did fire a gun, like poor old Margaret Skinner, you know, that. And then a lot of the background support that was provided by women would go unnoticed in such an archive.
I'm glad you've raised this issue about gender, because we've talked a lot up until this point in the discussion about the generation of state archives. And you gave us a very interesting chronology there of the evolution of state archives in the 19th century. For much of the 19th century, women were not prominent in the activities of the state. They weren't enfranchised. So state archives for a long period will not contain much of a public record of women. And I think that probably hampered the development of women's history as a discipline. We had a very top-down style of history, which, and we would be guilty of this in Irish history as well. I mean, the way in which Irish historical studies developed in its early years, and the privilege that was put on state archives, women and other groups as well were missing from those archives. So as a result of relying on those archives, those groups are also missing from the historical narrative for a long time. What we have seen with both the Bureau of Military History, but particularly the military service pensions, is just how valuable a source it is for the study of women's experience, not just the Margaret Skinners, as you mentioned, who themselves participated, but there are ancillary. There are women we would never have heard of. For example, those who died in the Rising were entitled, their dependents were entitled to pensions. Roger Catesman's sister was given a pension by the state because she had been dependent on him. He had supported her financially until the time of his death. We'd never probably have heard of Roger Casement's sister otherwise. So I think those tangential stories of women also emerge quite strongly.
Katrina, you want to come in on that?
I think everything Marie says is true up to a point. But one of the things we're overlooking is that state archives can also contain vast amounts of social history and women's history. Everyone has forgotten about the Women's History Project, which flourished in the 1990s, and which did a survey of records relating to women as far as possible all over Ireland. And that provided an entry point, if you like, into using the state archives and other archives to advance the study of women's history. For example, if you look at the outrage papers, which are the papers of the police during the 19th century, you're going to find lots of information about women engaging in food riots during the famine, an underexplored subject. They turn up everywhere. It's just that they're not catalogued in that kind of way. So it requires a different archival perspective, if you like, in terms of looking at how women show up in archives. There's a lot of social history in state archives that has been underexplored. As regards to the service pensions files. Everything Marie says is true. You find all kinds of things that you wouldn't expect to find. And that in itself as a collection is a kind of shadow social history of a part of Ireland in the 20th century, because you've got information about poverty, about illness, about trauma, which is starting now to be explored properly in relation to the results of conflict. So I think there's more to it than separating out state archives into one category and treating other categories of records as being more conducive to that kind of information.
Neil, you want to come in on that?
I think Catherine is absolutely right. And the she's firstly about in terms of cataloguing and the way records were cataloged and the information was preceded for people in previous generations didn't always record diverse voices. But if we bring the discussion back into the early modern period with the rise of what are called the equity courts, where you need to go before a senior judge to seek equity, to seek a decision where there's no statute or common law precedent, women's voices emerge here too in great numbers, whereby they're seeking justice. They're seeking either royal justice or they're trying to claim lands, or they're widows in wills, and they're seeking through probate courts to have goods granted to them. And through these documents that in reality are oftentimes cumbersome, they're hard to use, they're written in complex language that it's often difficult, although very formulaic, it's often difficult to extract information from. So great effort needs to go to extract stories, but the information is there in these records, and particularly in the early modern period.
Now, Neil, I just want to ask you a question, just to clarify something, because we've already established that the Irish State Paper Office was established in 1867. I presume there was a Scottish State Paper Office, or was there?
Yes, there was, but it's actually...
Not a Welsh one, though, I believe.
No Welsh one. It's not a State Paper Office. It's a public record office. There was an Irish State Paper Office going back into the 17th century. It was in Dublin Castle, where the records of government were being stored. Although the understanding of who owned the records was very different. And for instance, in 1669, the government issues a proclamation saying, please stop taking the documents. And if you've taken them, put them back. They're not yours. They belong to the crown. So the understanding of state papers or private papers was much more fluid, especially for senior government officials in the early modern period, before legislation emerged to say these papers must be held and stored and cared for by the state.
Katrina, can I bring you in there? Now, I know that in the 1980s, the National Archives was established, which consolidated various archival institutions. So I just want to work back from that. What institutions are we talking about? So like what did it amalgamate? Yeah, because I know obviously the State Paper Office was established in Ireland in 1867. What other archival institutions were there that were later subsumed into the National Archives?
One, the State Paper Office, as Neil has just pointed out.
Yeah.
The State Paper Office exists in Dublin Castle for a very long time. I indeed worked there in the 1970s.
I shared a very cozy room with you, actually, back in the 1980s. You probably didn't know who I was then, but me, and I didn't know who you were. I mean, it was very intimate, Katrina. I mean, it was about room for about maybe a dozen people. Very atmospheric, though, but, I mean, pretty basic in terms of the facilities. We may come back to that in a second. Anyway, sorry to interrupt you.
Let's remember that a lot of people fell in love with the State Paper Office precisely because of its intimacy. People staring at each other across the table while they're reading documents led to all kinds of interesting romances. We miss that now. That's not available in the same way. But the State Paper Office's job, as Neil has so rightly pointed out, was there to keep the records of the administration. And very luckily, due to a bureaucratic inertia, the records of the State Paper Office in Dublin Castle were not transferred, as they should have been, to the Public Record Office in the Four Courts in time to be burned in 1922. Therefore, we still retain the records of the Chief Secretary's Office, which was the main executive body overseeing government in Ireland at the time, from the 1790s up to 1922, with gaps, of course, but it's a remarkable collection, probably the single biggest collection of material relating to 19th century Ireland anywhere in the world.
Now, there's been several references here to the fire in the Four Courts. I just want to establish something. I people can contradict me if I'm wrong on this, but... my understanding is that the view, and I'm thinking of that recent book by Michael Fuhrer, and he had an article based on it in History Ireland, where he contradicts the idea that the State Paper Office was deliberately mined by the anti-treaty forces. Like, in other words, he establishes that it was a casualty of war rather than a malicious piece of vandalism. Would that be the consensus of everyone here, or does anyone disagree with that? I mean, can we move on from that at this stage, that it was the result of an act of war? I mean, the point is that the place was shelled by the pro-treaty forces, you know, so both sides, if you like, are equally to blame, if you want to put it like that. Katrina, what's your view on that?
Well, I have mixed feelings about that, Tommy. I mean, it's nice to be able to shift the blame into a general thing like conflict, and there's no doubt that the Civil War was the proximate cause of the destruction of the Public Record Office. Nonetheless, Ernie O'Malley made himself very comfortable for 3 months in a nice judge's chamber with his lovely Vasari Prince and his beautiful illustrated edition of Sing, and was there for 3 months looking about him. Behind his back was 800 years of Irish history, and it didn't seem to strike him at any point that this might be worth preserving. There were also approaches made on 3 occasions by people like the Royal Society of Antiquaries to the anti-treaty forces in the Four Courts to beg them to try to preserve the records in the Public Record Office. Michael Fuhrer's book is very convincing, and definitely there's fault on both sides. The pro-treaty forces deserve blame too for shelling that particular side, if you like, of the complex where the records were stored. I'm not sure, after years of obsessing over this and going nuts over it, when I went to work in the Public Record Office first in the 1970s, there was this pall of depression hanging over the place, and it was certainly the reason why the state invested so poorly in archives for many, many years. It's only when we get the National Archives Act in 1986 that things start to improve in terms of investment and staffing and so forth.
Does that go back to my point about the book review, the Library of Alexandria, that it was neglect rather than cataclysmic destruction that did in for it, you know?
Yes, well, in our brilliance, we managed to do both. In other words...
Now, I want to bring...
And then we neglected them shockingly for years afterwards.
Right. We'll come back to that in a second. I want to bring Marie in here now on the establishment of the other state on the island, the establishment of Northern Ireland, this is one of these problems. What is the anniversary, Marie? What is the accepted anniversary for the establishment of Northern Ireland? Because it's a bit of a moving target, just like this state. Next year?
Yeah, first of all, just before I get, I wanted to come back in on that point Katrina made, and I have to say... Or as a historian, I do tend usually to favour the cock-up rather than the conspiracy theory with regard to the destruction of the Record Office. And also the point there about Ernie O'Malley and his plush surroundings. Just some of the wonderful vignettes you find, the one I came across in the National Archives itself, when one of the first bodies set up to look at civilian compensation, the Compensation Ireland Commission, was operating in 1922, and they were looking for accommodation, and they asked Rory O'Connor because they used the Four Courts, and they were told that they couldn't. But to move on to Northern Ireland, yes, I don't know where this notion that there's any debate about the anniversary of Northern Ireland comes from. The Government of Ireland Act was passed, it was enacted in December 1920, and the provisions of it came into effect on the 3rd of May 1921. So while it might make for a nice story to go through various different potential dates, really, I think... to my mind, there's never been much debate among historians of partition as to what the date of the establishment of Northern Ireland is, the date on which the provisions of the Government of Ireland Act come into effect. And it's on the 4th of May, then the following day, the Lord Lieutenant moves the writs for the elections to the Parliament of Northern and Southern Ireland.
Okay, now I see, in relation to Northern Ireland, it seems to me that there are three elements like to its establishment. One is the establishment of special constabulary, because that gives the Northern Ireland its own military force, essentially. Second is the establishment of the political institutions, which you just talked about there, and thank you for clarifying that. And then the third thing is to establish the apparatus of archives and all the things we've just been talking about. It's not the thing that would would immediately become apparent to anyone. And maybe, Ray, if you want to come in on this as well, you know, like, whose idea was it to establish the PRONI? You know, I mean, it's not the first thing that spring to mind, you know, when you're in the state formation, or is it? You know, am I getting that wrong?
Well, I suppose when you have a new government set up, you need a repository for the collection of the public record that is going to be generated by that government. And in that regard, both the Irish Free State and Northern Ireland would have been following in the tradition of the British Public Record Office and the Irish one. And I think when we look to the origins of PRONI, and Ray may be able to say a bit more about that, I think that this is a good point to highlight just how lucky we have been on both throughout the island in some of the personalities who have been responsible for the preservation of our archives over the centuries. Katrina spoke earlier about the work of Herbert Wood in recording what was held in the record office before the fire, and I gather he was quite involved in trying to reconstruction efforts afterwards. One of Wood's colleagues in the old Irish Public Record Office, David Chart, D.A. Chart, moved up to the Ministry of Finance in Northern Ireland and was put in charge of PRONI. And the evolution of PRONI owes a lot to his skills as an archivist. And PRONI since then has been extremely lucky with the quality of many of its directors and archivists. Just to name a few people would be familiar with would be the likes of Brian Traynor and Anthony Malcolmson. And the fact that we have such a fine archival repository for such a relatively small jurisdiction owes an awful lot to the work of the archival profession on the island of Ireland.
What would you say, Marie, because it has been said, you know, I'm going to say it here, that the establishment of PRONI, this massively resourced thing, was a piece of hubris on the part of the unionist regime, just like the building of that huge building of Stormont was. How do you respond to that?
Yes, that's one argument. I suppose they did need a record office, though. They did have a government. They had the apparatus of a government. They had a legal framework. There was an onus on them to have a repository in which to deposit their public record. Now, I think then, PRONI, of course, is quite different from the National Archives in Dublin. Anyone who's visited it, it's a hybrid. It's almost a cross between the National Library and the National Archives in that it has large collections of private records as well, private estate records similar to those held in the National Archives. How that came about, maybe it's a process of evolution. I'm not as familiar with that, but certainly I know the same argument would be made about things like the setting up of the Ulster Museum and later the Ulster Folk and Transport Museum, and the geographer Easton Evans has been criticised by some as being a bit of an Ulster nationalist and flying the flag for the unionist government by setting up these Northern Ireland-based Ulster institutions. Now, I know there's criticism of that view of him. There may have been an element of truth to it, but I think a lot of these institutions took on a life of their own beyond that limited remit.
Ray, do you want to come in there on just, you know, the innovations of PRONI, if you like, what distinguished it from it in some of the things that Marie has alluded to?
I think it's worth remembering that the act setting up PRONI was 1923. If my memory is right, it gets a royal assent in June of 1923. Now, for a new state being set up, that's quite a remarkable experience that within, 2 years, perhaps a state getting going, it's designed a piece of legislation to set up an institution. And I think also remarkable, almost every archive, government archive around the world in the last 30 years has had this legislation tinkered with, changed. I mean, whether that's our own national archives or what have you, but PRONI never has. So it's worth remembering that when it was set up, it was clearly set up with some care, that the legislation which was drafted, A, happened very quickly, and B, I think, was something that was thought about quite carefully. So, you know, PRONI was not sort of something, I think, which the various parties in Ulster Unionism thought this was a way of immortalizing ourselves. I think there was a very practical reason for setting it up. To run a state, you need to be able to tax. To tax, you need information. Information is stored in archives. So, you know, the creation of those sorts of archives was important legally within the state. And, you know, you can think about the foil fisheries case, the ban fisheries case. All these required Prony, as it became, to produce archives, which became part of legal cases. So there was a very practical reason for setting it up. But I think the second reason, and I think this is Maria's quite right about this, Prony is a unique institution. It's a cross between an English County Record Office and a National Archives or the Public Record Office. So it's something that was created, not necessarily to deal simply with the Irish, the new Northern Irish state, but it was created also to be an English-style local record office. And that's what it did almost from its inception. May have been to take in papers to replace things that were destroyed, but it very quickly became, I mean, very quickly within the 1920s, became a place which people would do local research and develop local research in ways that I don't think you could describe as Northern Ireland nationalism, but certainly, you know, expressed a local identity.
Sorry, Neil, you wanted to come in on that?
I absolutely agree with Ray, and in the National Archives of Kew, there are records between Dublin Castle officials, both when it was a British administration and an Irish administration, back and forth, and then north and south between Dublin and Belfast after independence. And there were very careful choices made about what was going to be physically carted up to Belfast from Dublin. And you've got people like Chart, you've got the Ulster King at Arms, who's the chief genealogist, who is, to use an unfortunate term, he's targeting papers to bring Norths, to create and to help write a history of Northern Ireland, and it's a pedigree for Northern Ireland.
This sounds a bit like the old annals, you know, that you kind of create a pedigree, you know?
Yeah, there were very active choices being made. Pre-destruction of the forecourts anyway.
Now, Katrina, because you've already alluded to this, like when you started working in the Public Record Office in the 1970s, right? When you looked north at that time, were you overcome with what I would describe as prony envy, you know, that this very, very lavishly funded institution north of the border, which contrasts sadly with what we had down here?
Absolutely. I mean, we were consumed with jealousy at the fact that they still have far more staff than we have down in the south. I think the latest count was that Prony has 78 staff and we have 55. And both of them compare poorly to countries with similar populations like Scotland and Denmark. Now, everybody has different remits, and that has to be remembered. As Neil said and as Ray said, the material that's held in Prony encompasses not just the records of the state, but also local authority records, which have been very badly served here in the south until quite recently. They also have some church records, which again is a vexed question here. One of the great advances, and in fact, it might be worth just deviating slightly here to say that one of the drivers of the use of archives and the digitization of archives has come from genealogy. That genealogical records became very important when Roots appeared on television in America. There was a worldwide explosion of people taking an interest in their family history. And in both cases, in our case with the 1901 and 1911 census, which wasn't in the possession of the state archives in 1922, or perhaps they would have been split too. As it is, it's an All-Ireland collection. And people from north, south, and internationally can access those records online, and there's huge interest in them. So, we were jealous, and we're even more jealous now because they have a lovely new building in the Titanic Quarter, and we're still struggling to get a new building built on our site in Bishop Street. There's certainly huge differences between the two. But there's also, and we mustn't forget, an issue of conflict, that Northern Ireland experienced a 30-year conflict. And a lot of money came into the province during that period to allow for the development of the archives. It increased exponentially in terms of staff and finances at that time, whereas we didn't. So, yeah, we're jealous, but we wish them the very best because the more we digitize things and the more we cooperate with each other, the better it is for researchers, family historians, everybody else who wants to look at the material. And again, Beyond 2022 is going to address some of those issues for everybody.
Okay, well, that's what I want to get on to Neil finally, just to talk about the Beyond 2022 project. And you can chip in on this, Katrina, as well. I suppose, Neil, my first question would be, before you talk about the positives of this project, in broad strokes, I mean, could you give an indication to listeners what was lost in the destruction of the State Paper Office back in 1922? Well, don't just say everything.
The old trope and the old lament was everything. And I certainly would have been guilty of that while I was a research student and would have been a consensus in many ways. But we, in the Beyond 2022 team, we've certainly, we're not finding that anymore. We start, and Herbert Wood is, you know, he is our guiding light, and his 1919 inventory of the Public Record Office is where we start. If we want to quickly move to the positive, we can see what's destroyed, and he has given a description of what was in the record treasury in the forecourt.
So that's your Bible, then. That's what your starting point. Yeah.
We in the project, in Beyond 2022, we call that we've turned it into a digital database, and we call it our inventory of loss. So that's the sad side. We also have an inventory of survival, where we are seeking either replacement records, facsimiles, and 19th century editions or 18th century editions of records that were printed and published, clerical copies that have ended up in London, for instance, or in Prony in Northern Ireland. We are looking for records of 19th century academics, genealogists, historians whose private papers were sold off after they died. And in particular, the Americans, they were very keen in buying sort of 19th century transcriptions of 15th, 16th, 17th century records. And we are able to slowly begin to, through digitization and through transcription, to stitch these records back into our inventory of survival, but also stitch them together to begin to recreate what we're actually calling a meta-archive. We're able to go beyond what was in the forecourts itself by bringing in papers that were elsewhere, so say in Prony, or private papers that ended up in Prony, or records that were in England, government records in England. We're able to merge these records back together in a really, really innovative and, well, particularly complicated ways. But we are working to make them, as Katrina's right, we're working to make them as searchable as we can. So internationally, people can log into the site. These are this work is for the public good, and that people will be able to log in, search, and through really innovative and very clever technologies, and we're trying to extract what are called entities, so people and places, from the records, and link them together, so that usually archives are quite siloed, in that the records of, say, the Chancery or the Exchequer, they won't be linked to each other. But we're trying to move beyond that now with the advances in computer search technologies, to be able to link all of these entities, so people and places together. So it's much easier to search across an archive than it traditionally has been.
Now, just to get slightly technical, are we talking about facsimiles of documents or transcriptions of documents? Because obviously a facsimile is not easily searchable, or is it?
No, it's not. So we're talking about both. We're talking about anything we can get our hands on, first of all, and then we have to make a decision within the resources we have of what we're going to prioritize in the next 20 months, I think it is, which is quite terrifying when you stand back and think about it. But for instance, if we deem, we're trying to put back together, I mentioned it at the start, the records of the Irish Records Commissioners. So where records were either transcribed with the intention of publishing, or were published, we run them through software, which you teach machines how to read the handwriting that it is presented within the digital images. And these can spit out increasingly sophisticated transcriptions up to about 95% accuracy. And you then need a human, you need a historian to sit and correct them to the best of our abilities. But we're also using technology that learns to understand what is a noun, what is a person, a place, or a thing, and it lifts out automatically on a scale that no human could do these places, people, whatever it is. And then if somebody comes along and searches for Kinsale or searches for Murphy in a townland in Monaghan or in County Clare or whatever it is, we are working towards being able to have all of these entities, as we call them, identified for people. And when they search, they will pop up on the screen.
Now, that sounds very like what Trinity College have done with the 1641 depositions. Maybe, Ray, you could come in on this, because I have been using depositions with my Griffith College students. Not that they thank me for it, but they are very nicely transcribed. But you can look at the original facsimile and you can look at the kind of cleaned up digital copy. But the point is, you end up with something far, far greater than the sum of its parts. I mean, in the way that Neil has just described, that you can search things, you know, up, down, sideways, places, names. I mean, it transforms the whole the whole archival process. Ray, any comments on the depositions quickly? Because that was a marvelous project.
I mean, absolutely. I think we need to remember two things, about this whole process. First of all, you know, we all think we're doing something terribly new, but in fact, what we're doing is exactly what they were doing in the 19th century. That is, they were taking the most recent form of technology and using it to make records available. Now, in their case, the most recent form of technology was the steam press, and they produced the calendars of state papers, Ireland, the calendars of state papers domestic, the calendars of state papers, Rome. I can go on and on and on and on. And these are things that we still use. So now we talk about indexing online, but in fact, in the past, it was a printed index. So the basic idea is the same. It's basically about access. And it's interesting from your list of when archives begin, the idea of opening up archives and making them available is something very much associated with the early 18th century, with the Enlightenment process. So, you know, that's really what archives are all about. And I think the second thing I would, you know, point out is that, you know, archives are just bits of paper. I mean, they're bits of information. To turn that information into history requires a historian. It requires somebody to ask questions. And here we go back, you know, to what Katrina and others were talking about. I mean, the fact that we all knew there was material on women in archives, but women weren't important. It's only when people started to ask questions about women that suddenly the material started to emerge from the archive. And the depositions are a very good example of that.
This is a good illustration, I think, that even in the natural sciences, that imagination is essential.
Well, absolutely. I mean, historical imagination. If Lewis Warren, in an article many years ago, you know, said the archives would take you so far, and then it just had to be that way. You know, knowing what you know about the context, the explanation of this book was this. But very good example of this is in depositions. And people talk about, you know, there are...
Actually, Reagan, just stop you, just for our listeners, just give us a quick definition. What are the depositions? I mean, just very, very broad strokes.
I mean, I think that, you know, this is important, because when you use archives, you've got to know about the context. And the depositions were taken in three series. After the outbreak of the Rising in 1641. And they were essentially, I suppose, insurance claims and also giving up material for prosecutions for those who had murdered, those who had uttered traitorous words. And as the series go on, these things become more and more complicated. They were put together by people, seemingly asking questions which provide a framework for a deposition. So some people have raised the question, well, why is there not more rape in the depositions? Because, you know, we all know in cases of civil war, this sort of thing happens. And, you know, there's been a lot of stuff done now on the War of Independence and the Civil War, and, you know, the way in which some women were treated in that. So, but the reason there are only two cases, I think, of rape in the depositions is simply because nobody asked them the question.
Yeah, and, so, and that could be described as well as an accidental archive. You know, that yeah. it was drawn up probably, I mean, my impression is it was drawn up. First of all, I think the people giving the deposition thought they were insurance claims, right, which they weren't. And it was kind of a bit of occupational therapy, you know, to deal with traumatized people, you know, who'd been attacked and plundered and so forth. Marie, I want to bring you in on this, because this raises another aspect of this, is the you know, digitization and what I would describe as the democratization of the archives. What effect has that had on the whole business of commemoration, which we're now been involved in the last few years?
It's had a number of effects on more than just commemoration. I think Ray is right to highlight the significance of the digitization of the 1641 depositions, which were stored in the library in Trinity for years. And thanks to the efforts of Jane Olmeyer are now and others who work on that period have been made so freely accessible. And those of us who work in academia can see the benefits for our own research and for generations of students of having access to things like 1641, like the Bureau of Military History and the pensions that we mentioned earlier. And I think the huge importance of that to our profession has really been brought home to us in the last 6 months, when suddenly we couldn't get into the archives. So I think now more than ever, are we thankful to those who have put so much effort into digitizing these resources. And to that, I would add Katrina and the work on, as she's mentioned before, on the 1901 and the 1911 census, which thankfully had never got as far as the Public Record Office in time to be burned in 1922. In terms of democratized, so it's hugely important for our profession, for the historical profession, but also for those who might not be professional historians and want to research their own family yeah. interest in the period. It's hugely important for that. For commemoration, I think that there's a bit of a two-edged sword here. I think had we not the benefit of the decade of centenaries, the Bureau of Military History and the pensions would have sat quite happily without much government funding in the old military archives building in Cathal Brua Barracks. But commemoration is a way of getting the attention of government. And suddenly the Irish government has got very interested in its decade of commemorations. And that has been to our advantage in redressing the years of underfunding of archives that Katrina has talked about. Now, I know it's been very targeted in that, and other archives have not been as well treated. But from the benefit, from the point of view of the historians, commemoration was a very shiny carrot to wave in front of the government to try and get some movement on release. Not just release, I mean, we're talking about digitization. The first job was even getting things like the Bureau of Military History released in hard copy in the first place. So I think commemoration has been a useful excuse for us to get governments to move on accessibility to archives.
Katrina, you want to come in on that?
Do, and I appreciate what Marie has said very much. The Bureau of Military History was released in 2003, long before we were even beginning to think about the decade of commemorations. And it was the result of a very long battle on the part of Peter Young, who was the military archivist at the time, and myself, constantly banging away at it. And I still remember the morning in 1999 when we were summoned to government buildings, where the records were held, by the way, in a strong room in Merrion Street, not in the military archives, in beautifully organized boxes, and had been there for all the years. And they told us they were going to release them. And we went and had a glass of whiskey at 12 o'clock in the day to celebrate victory, only to find that poor Peter, who I never saw again after that day, died a month later. And it was just so tragic that someone who had put so much work into this didn't live to see its fruits. Now, Marie is perfectly right in relation to the military service pensions files, which seemed to a lot of people to be a more sensitive collection, although there was a lot of fear about what would happen when the Bureau records were to be released. Were they going to start up ancient feuds in different parts of the country about differing accounts of what went on? We insisted it was so long ago it wouldn't matter, and we proved to be correct. And the same is happening with the military service pensions files, which are directly attributable to the decade of centenaries. And it is, I think, going to be one of the great legacy projects funded by the state of the decade of centenaries that we have, not just the release of these records and their digitization, but a Rolls-Royce catalogue, which really matters. And Neil will know what I'm talking about there in terms of being able to put the resources into cataloguing everything as well as you possibly can.
I mean, isn't the moral of the story here that I mean, it seems that first of all, in relation to the commemoration itself, but also in relation to access to archives, that there seems to be an unease in kind of official government circles. And in fact, the public have proved to be remarkably responsible. That's not too patronizing a word to use in their use of this material when they've got access to it. I mean, they've absolutely just lapped it up, like whether it be the 1901-1911 census or indeed all the various other digital archives that have been mentioned here. Marie, you want to come in on that?
Yes, I do, and I agree with that. And I think it's a wonderful resource, obviously, for someone like me who it's my profession. It's hugely important. But I think it is also, to go back to your point about democratization, it is important that those who don't do it as a profession but have the interest should be able to do it. And I'd contrast here the way in which we have made the 1901 and the 1911 census available freely online with the accessibility to the census for England, Scotland and Wales, for which you need paid access to either to some of these professional genealogical sites. And I know that people like Ancestry have put the money into things like preserving and conserving some of the burned records from the First World War attestation papers. And that's why they are only accessible through those commercial websites, but I do have a serious problem with the fact that state archives are hidden behind paywalls in instances like that.
But actually, Marie, and maybe Ray can come in on this, because you know you're both professional academic historians, right? But is there a sense that these digital resources puts it up to those of us in the professional academy? In other words, like that Gerard and Joe Soap, they can write scholarly articles densely footnoted, referring to sources, just like yourself and Ray.
And why shouldn't they? It's there for everybody to use. I think we might very well write it, ask questions that would be maybe of more of an interest to professional historians. Different audiences will ask different questions and look for different answers. But one of the things we're very lucky with in this country, on this island, is the quality of local history societies and local history publications. And I rely on them a lot myself. And I think it's great that these archives are not just confined to those of us who work in academia, and that they're freely available to anybody who wants to and has the time and the interest to look at them.
Yeah. So Ray, how do you feel about all these people out there practicing without a license, as it were?
I think the first point I would make is that if we talk about access, I mean, this is not a new problem. Back in the 1940s, there was talk about publishing the depositions by the Irish Manuscripts Commission, and the project was pulled, and it was pulled for two reasons. One was finance said it cost too much. But secondly, the Taoiseach's department were very worried.
Yes.
Old passions. So this question of, you know, archives making political statements and, you know, stirring up problems for the state. An archive is not necessarily a good thing for the state as well. So I think that's the first thing. I think the second point about working without a license, so to speak. I think, first of all, I come back to the point which I made earlier, and that is really, it's about the questions you ask of these things. And Marie's quite right. I mean, people in local societies with a passion for the local experience will not ask the same questions as I would ask, or you would ask, or Marie would ask. They will ask very different questions, and that can only be a good thing, because that will broaden our perspective on how the past works. I mean, I often think of, you know, modern economists who most of the time can't tell you what's going on despite the vast quantity of information which they have at their disposal. We have tiny bits of information preserved in archives, and we're trying to recreate a whole society. And it's not something which you can do terribly easy. It needs as many perspectives on the past as you can possibly get, local, national, regional, all the rest. And I think that's was part of the great strength of Prone, was that it encouraged, right back from the 1960s, long before the trouble started, but more money flew in. I mean, they encouraged education in schools, getting people involved with this material, encouraging them to explore their own pasts and their own places. And that's becoming more and more important, I think, you know, as we become part of larger and larger political and economic units. People look for things that they can relate to. And that local experience in the past really can be extremely important. And some of the finest contributions in Irish history, I think, have been made by exactly those people.
Now, I'm just looking at the clock here, and we're being beaten by it again. This has been a marvellous discussion. But Neil, I want to go to you, just going back to the 2022, the Beyond 2022 project. When will the fruits of this be available to the public? And will it be free access? What way will it work?
It's absolutely going to be free access. Everything is going to be freely available through the website. We will launch what we've done. We have Tim Murta working in Prony, and myself, and Sarah Hendricks working in Britain, and Kieran Wallace and Dave Brown in Ireland. And we are feeding information all the time, what we're finding in archives across our areas, and in the United States, and in France, and across Europe. And we're feeding this into a team of computer scientists in the ADAPT Centre in Trinity, all under the guidance of Peter Crooks, a historian at Trinity College. And with the time and the resource we have available, we will have a full inventory of loss and survival created by June 2022, the centenary anniversary of the destruction of the forecourts.
Write that down, listeners.
Yes.
Katrina, you want to come in on that?
I do. I want to say that we need to praise Peter Crooks, whose brainchild this was, to say two things. First, can we trust the Irish public to behave properly and intelligently towards digitized sources? They have proven that they can do so. And lastly, that Beyond 2022 is a miraculous project. It should not come to an end in 2022. This is an internationally important archival project that needs to extend further into the 2020s so that we can create a very broad-reaching archive of Irish materials anywhere in the world that they can be accessed. And congratulations to the team who are bringing this about.
Neil, one last
Thank
word.
You. Thank you, Katrina. Yeah, it's a hugely important collaboration. It's the first time that we've had National Archives in Dublin, National Archives of the UK, Public Record Office, the Irish Manuscripts Commission, and Trinity College Library as what we're calling core partners. And then we have participating institutions, so the major archives and repositories in Ireland, on the island of Ireland, in Britain, in the United States, and further afield. And as the word spreads about what we're doing, we are slowly but surely being overwhelmed with, you need to have a look at this, have a think about that. So we're doing our very best to put all this together in the next few years to have something really fantastic ready for June 2022.
Well, I tell you, it's great to have a good news story in relation to the destruction of the Public Records Office and indeed the general destruction of the Civil War 1922-23. Listen, we're going to have to wrap it up there. I'd like to thank our panel, Marie Coleman, Katrina Crowe, Ray Gillespie, Neil Johnston. Just to say that the next History Ireland Head School will be part of the Dublin History Festival in association with the National Library, and it will be, quote, Eye of the Storm, unquote, Dublin and the War of Independence. So I look forward to you tuning in for that one, listeners. Thank you very much.